This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Julian Ng here with me. Friday morning, 6 o'clock right now. It's March the 10th. Good morning, Jules.
Good morning.
Yeah, looking forward to the weekend?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, definitely. I'm definitely looking forward to the weekend. I don't know about you, but it seems to be wedding season at the moment. Do you feel the same way?
Really?
Yeah.
Lots Who's of getting married?
Or just friends. Friends generally getting married.
Oh, that's around. Interesting.
Yeah, so lots of weddings to attend this weekend. So looking forward to that. But today on the show, Jules, we have a great lineup ready over the next 4 hours, including the breakfast grill. Today, we'll be speaking to David Fong, president of the FinTech Association of Malaysia. Now, if you remember last year, Bank Negara issued the Financial Technology Regulatory Sandbox Framework. And what that made possible was the experimentation of fintech solutions within a live environment, but within certain boundaries and limited fallout possibilities. And the repercussions of that, it gave birth to a fintech association, specifically the FAOM, the Fintech Association of Malaysia, to represent the collective voices of fintechs in Malaysia. So, Julian, what are you going to be speaking to David Fong on the Breakfast Grill about?
Well, I'm going to ask them if Bank Negara's sandbox idea, which allows all these companies to play around in that particular sandbox. You know, imagine if your kids right on the beach are playing in a sandbox. That's what it is. They are allowed to experiment within that and try to pass all those regulatory tests within a year, after which they're out. Either they survive or they don't. Either they make it or they don't. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask David Fong whether this is a drag on the startup scene in Malaysia, whether this is something that slows down the industry from developing. Actually, it's not just Bank Negara that is the regulating authority here. The Securities Commission has issued a few ideas, allowed people to bring forward such ideas as equity crowdfunding platform, P2P lending, and so on. Yeah. So fintechs coming together and trying to come to terms, trying to navigate the regulatory scene here.
Well, you know, with fintech and regulation of fintech, I have to say it is, to me, a really difficult balance because you want to regulate this new industry because it's so related to, a crucial industry, the financial industry. But at the same time, you don't want to regulate it so much that you're hampering innovation. You need to let it breathe and grow on its own merits. So, I mean, how do you think that balance can be achieved?
That's the question that I'm going to ask David Fong. And I suppose from Bank Negara's viewpoint is that they want to maintain the integrity of the financial system because Dato Muhammad Ibrahim, the new Bank Negara governor taking over from Governor Zetti, he said that fintechs are in a position to take away about 30 to 40% of existing banking profits. Now, that's a very serious thing. And imagine a situation where the fintechs go unfettered. They have the ability to shake the banks, to wobble the rice bowl of the banks. And even more so, I think certain fintechs, as we've seen in China, can cheat consumers, can shake the integrity of the financial system. So I think Bank Negara is there to ensure that this is orderly, but orderliness can, sometimes also get in the way.
Yeah. You don't want to be too orderly until, it becomes rote and you're not encouraging innovation and progress of technology. But more on that on the Breakfast Grill, the FinTech Association of Malaysia, that should be an interesting one, 8 o'clock this morning. And after the Breakfast Grill on current affairs, we continue our look at MH370, specifically the hope that new leads have given us. So in the last 3 years, since MH370 has disappeared, there's been several new leads. In fact, some academicians and independent investigators have been assisting the victims' families to find new leads. So you remember the official search was called off in January. But we've got all sorts of people trying to help the families gain some closure, find the missing aircraft, including Blaine Gibson, who is an independent investigator from America. He has found some debris by scouring beaches, and here he is explaining what he hopes the three governments involved in the search would do.
The scientists already recommended a new underwater search area, and they didn't go there to look for it. That should have been done, because that combined the Inmarsat data, the debris, the oceanography, and the aerial search records. The other thing I want to see is the officials, the governments, to do searches of coastlines for debris. There's no reason the governments cannot do what I was doing. They've got a lot more money, a lot more means, a lot better connections. They've found zero. I've found 15. I hope they catch up, and I hope they pass me.
That was Blaine Gibson. Now, he has been quite active in, you know, being an independent investigator for MH370. He's gone off and done his own thing. I think he's had some choice words to say before this about where he thought officials are going wrong with the search area. To be completely honest with you, it's really difficult, right? Because, you know, if data points to one direction and then you've got leads from other directions, it's hard. How do you canvass an entire world's ocean, right? Mm-hmm. Granted, there's an area that they have narrowed it down, specifically narrowed it down. But I use the term narrow down generously, because it's not really narrow at all. It's such a huge area to look for. So, yeah.
And this guy, is he being hired by anybody, or is he doing this pro bono or something?
Well, he's trying to help the families look for it. But again, you know, it's one of the biggest aviation mysteries in the world. So, of course, there are people who will always be interested in this, either for monetary reasons or for the fame that it will bring them, or just simply to solve this mystery, right? But he has been working closely with the family, so we'll have to see whether that crowdsourcing effort that we spoke about yesterday, Julian, from the families, from Voice 370, is going to help fund an independent search. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the way he speaks, he makes it sound so easy, like as though he has a method, you know,
right.
Like the method. I wonder whether he does.
Well, that's true. And whether the governments involved, so Malaysia, China and Australia, whether, you know, they take leads from independent searchers like Blaine Gibson, whether they take it seriously or not. So it's something we should ask, and we will be asking Dato' Sri Azharuddin, Director General of the Malaysian Department of Civil Aviation, as well as Professor Charita Patiarachi, who is an oceanographer. Those will be questions we will explore on current affairs today at 8:35 a.m. The possibilities and clues that will drive the search for the missing plane. So make sure you stay tuned for that. And on the property show today, Muhammad Tariq Tan Sri Abu Sahid, Managing Director of Maju Group. Now, interesting because given housing affordability remaining a challenge here in Malaysia, Maju Group has launched this new campaign called Own It Now, Sure Not. Interesting.
It's always nice when you put some Malaysianese into your campaign.
So Own It Now, Sure Not campaign is to educate millennials in buying a property. So what this campaign is about, Jules, is that they are rolling out a scheme to allow buyers to pay for the down payment in 42 months. Mm-hmm. That's the down payment.
That's short of 4 years.
Exactly.
Three and a half years.
Just to pay for the down payment. So we're going to take a look at what this scheme entails, how much of a game changer it's going to be in the property sector.
Well, to me, this is nothing more than a loan within a loan. You know, they inceptionize the thing, right? They put a loan within a loan, and you're taking a full long-term loan on the rest of your payment. But with a down payment, you take another loan for that, which requires a shorter-term payment.
Right.
I don't know if people will have the ability to service two loans. Maybe I'm reading the situation differently.
Well, the idea is that, you know, as time progresses, as you get better at your career, your the ability for you to earn more is there. So, but you know, within,
it's just 42 months.
I know, though. Exactly.
So you got to be such a star.
You have to rise up.
Star employee.
Exactly. You have to rise up the career ladder in 4 years. But I'm curious to know whether this is going to be a feasible method for financing a house. Maybe, you know, again, we're back to that that key conundrum of who can afford to buy a house and whether they should be buying a house at the moment.
And also of relevance would be the interest rates that you're going to be charged for taking this loan.
Oh, yes.
I mean, if it's free, it will help house buyers quite a bit. As we know, houses are so expensive these days. And then there was that particular controversy about developers applying housing loan to house buyers, which we discussed at length when the news came out. And the suggestion was at that time that the interest rates are going to be very, very expensive, above 18% or something like that.
Yeah. So we'll have to find out more as Tang Wei Lin will be speaking to Muhammad Faik Tan Sri Abu Sahir, Managing Director of Maju Group, on the Property Show today, 9:30 a.m. Don't miss that. But very quickly, let's take a look at some news that has come out yesterday. Now, Stella Lim and Nanya Prakash Munyandi, both of them are Malaysians who were participating in the UN's World Food Programme in North Korea. They have been allowed to leave the country. So that has been facilitated by both governments. But now we're looking at the other nine who are still stuck in North Korea. They have not been allowed to leave Pyongyang. And yesterday it was reported that Prime Minister Najib Razak had a two-minute conversation with the counsellor at the Malaysian Embassy in Pyongyang, Muhammad Nur Azrin, who's still there. Apparently all is well, but there's been, you know, of course, heightened tensions and serious concern if you can't get yourself and your family out of an escalating situation. It's bound to cause some worries. Azrin's there with his wife, Iza Carmila Ramli, and their three young children.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, that's good news. So we got 2 out of the 11 coming back to Malaysia. 9 still there, very precarious situation over there. And the counselor over in the Malaysian embassy, he hasn't been booted out. What's the procedure? What's the protocol?
Yeah,
there?
So the ambassador has been called back to Putrajaya. So Pusma Putra called the ambassador back, and that was about a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, the rest of the staff at the embassy, who keeps the embassy running, they're still there and they've not been allowed to leave.
Oh, so part of the 11 would be staff?
Staff of the embassy,
okay.
Yes. So there's there are staff of the embassy, including their children, family and children, and some UN workers in North Korea who are Malaysians. Now, the UN workers have left. They have arrived safely in Beijing, but it is the embassy staff that we are worried about and will be keeping a close eye. Hopefully, both governments will be able to resolve something because, you know, Malaysia is also stopping North Koreans from leaving the country. And we're looking at 170-odd foreign workers in Sarawak as well. So that's something to keep an eye on. But in the US, Jules, there's been overnight news that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, he has come out in an interview to say he will not agree that carbon dioxide is the primary contributor to global warming. In fact, he told CNBC that measuring human impact on the climate was, quote him, very challenging, and that was tremendous agreement about this issue. This is the chief of the Environmental Protection Agency denying that carbon dioxide contributes to global warming.
So it's really going against the grain of what scientists and environmentalists around the world believe. I don't know whether he has any support for that, whether he's coming up with some newfound research.
Well, Donald Trump has called
his authority.
Yes, Donald Trump has called climate change a hoax. So this is really interesting because the chief of the EPA is saying something that is directly contradictory to his own agency's findings on greenhouse gas emissions. On the EPA website, it notes that carbon dioxide is the primary greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. And, you know, not just the EPA, but around the world, scientists around the world, environmental protection agencies around the world agree in almost every country that the planet's temperature is rising, and it is because of carbon emissions.
I mean, we can feel it too. Sometimes we feel that the weather has gone slightly wonky because it's supposed to be warm in a certain time of the year, and it's really cold. Other times, it feels extremely warm. The environment is certainly wreaking havoc on many people's lives today.
I don't know what to make of this. I find this completely baffling.
I think it's dangerous.
It is dangerous. Yes, I think that's true.
I think dangerous
is the right word to use, because this is a really dangerous signal as to how the administration of the EPA is going to view climate change. And climate change accords, for instance, as in the Paris Agreement that we saw. We'll have to see. Well, that's some troubling news coming out of the US this morning. 6:16 right now. We'll be back with more news after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Crazy Love by Van Morrison. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. 6:21 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng. Now, we came across an article from The Guardian that talked about people with superpowers. Superpowers mm-hmm. of forecasting the future.
Wow.
They are called super forecasters. not a very original.
Not a very creative name.
Original superpower name. But they've put their powers to good use in terms of forecasting when the next humanitarian crisis could happen. Because what they found is that a slow response to humanitarian crises will cost hundreds, if not thousands, of lives. According to some research, the deputy head of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the famine that hit Somalia between 2010 and 2012, some 260,000 people died, yet humanitarian assistance to the country had decreased. And this is because half the casualties of the people who died in that famine happened. They died even before the world was alerted that there was a famine happening.
Mm-hmm.
So super forecasters are saying that, well, if we can predict when the next crisis is going to happen, maybe we can avoid all these unnecessary deaths.
Yeah. So is it the case that what these guys do, try to collect all the funds and try to get the necessary administrative impediments out of the way, so that if or when the particular crisis happened, they can mobilize the funds very quickly.
Exactly. So I'm going to use, for instance, the START Network, which is a collection of NGOs. They manage a multi-donor fund, and what they've done is they've employed a crisis anticipation advisor. So he's a super forecaster, so to speak. And what he does is he uses all these different data points. A very smart man who uses technology and mathematics and physics and climate data, as well as being on the ground and having, ground access to information, which is something that decision makers don't have. So what NGOs have found is that decision makers don't have the confidence to make that decision or information to release funds to intervene before they see concrete evidence. And by that time, it's far too late. So these crisis anticipation advisors are on the ground. They're submitting early warnings. So, it's a red flag here and a red flag there. So funds can be activated in enough time. So by the time, aid arrives, it's not too late.
Yeah, I totally agree with the idea that the more you slow down things, the more people will suffer and the more the crisis would happen. There are the kind of crises and disasters that hit you, right? Slap you in the face and tell you, hey, this is happening right now. But there are yet others that requires a degree of activism. Otherwise, it takes such a long time to dismantle. I mean, we just celebrated World Women's Day, and we know that gender equality is something that takes such a long time to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
The eradication of corruption, the eradication of racism, for example, in America, I saw Hidden Figures, I watched Hidden Figures, and it's quite startling that right up to the 60s, racism still exists, and perhaps still exists till today in America and other parts of the world. So this apathy that we go through exists in crises that happen on the spot, disasters that are unforeseen, and the kind of problems and very, very toxic, the kind of toxic social cancers that we have that have lasted a lifetime, that takes such a long time.
Many generations, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it goes on and on and on. And, the question is how much activism we have to take in order to just rise up and try to do something about these things.
Okay, so you know, when I was reading this article, Julian, it struck me as, and I had a vision or had an image of those Hollywood movies about natural disasters or the end of the world disasters, and the scientists running to tell the president, to intercept the president of the United States, to say, this is happening, there's a wave coming, you know, there's a tsunami, there's an asteroid going to hit the world. It reminded me of that scene, and I wonder whether futurologists or super forecasters are perceived like that, because, you know, sometimes the things they say could be considered out there. If someone came up to you and say, I can predict the future, there's an asteroid on the way to hit, you know, China, or, you know, wipe out the half
world.
The world, exactly. So you would go, are you crazy? Are you crazy? So I wonder whether we can believe super forecasters or futurologists. Now, it took me a long time to come to terms with that term, futurologist, mm-hmm. because I thought, what is a futurologist? You telling me that you can predict what is going to happen? But essentially, they're just looking at data points, right? Data points to predict whether something is likely to happen in the future and to give you fair warning about it.
Well, I think that if you think about natural disasters, for example, people are now instituting systems which can predict, for example, earthquakes, tsunamis, and so on. And at least from that viewpoint, you can take steps to know what to do when that happens. The other thing, political crises and insurgencies and wars, they don't happen spontaneously, right? You see people arguing a bit, quarreling a bit, and then hurling accusations at each other. You would be able to kind of feel a certain flashpoint that's mm-hmm. developing in hotspots around the world. And I guess, according to this article, what they say is that it really doesn't take rocket scientists to figure out that something is about to happen somewhere. So let's prepare for that.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist, but it does take a super forecaster. So that's the superpower right there.
I wonder if he can make money out of this. Because if he can predict events with a degree of accuracy, these events really affect markets,
well,
financial markets as well.
That's why I said he's used his superpower for good. Now, he's doing it for humanitarian aid rather than saying, well, I'm going to buy stocks in, you know, food companies.
Or sell stocks.
Exactly, or sell stocks before this disaster happens. The other article, the other piece of news that caught our attention was the fact that the Netherlands has found a very creative solution to its happy problem of a shortage of prison inmates. Mm-hmm. So imagine that the Netherlands has had such a surplus of unused cells in its prisons that now it's renting out some of its prisons to Belgium and Norway, like an apartment, rent. Like, they're collecting rent because they have such a surplus of space in their prisons. And what they've done actually now is instead of also renting it to Belgium and Norway, they're thinking about a creative use to this happy problem they have. They want to turn former prisons into centres for asylum seekers. It's just to give you some context, Jules, you're talking about a third of Dutch prison cells that sits empty.
Mm-hmm.
They've managed to eradicate that much crime in the country.
So
imagine
when
that.
You say a third, are these a third of existing cells which have to be shared with existing inmates, or a third of all the prison cells where one-third of them are empty?
The latter, because it
would be kind of weird to share.
not putting refugees next to convicted criminals, but the fact that you've got a third of prison cells in Netherlands that are empty is because the Dutch have this ingrained pragmatism when it comes to regulating law and order. They believe mm-hmm. in law enforcement that puts rehabilitation over incarceration. So if you think about in the US, where they have, prisons filled to the brim, the problem of overcrowding in prisons, In Netherlands, it's the opposite. So much space that now they're thinking about converting former prisons. What a remarkable problem to have.
Absolutely, I mean, wonderful.
Yeah, wonderful. We've got the 6:30 news bulletin. Lynn Mark is standing by. Next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Bad Company Can't Get Enough. Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng here on The Morning Run. 6:40 right now, and it's official. Americans now drink more bottled water than soda. Apparently, it's a shift that, you know, just 10 years ago might seem unthinkable, that consumers would buy a packaged version of something that you can get free from a tap. But apparently, bottled water sales have been growing in the US ever since the arrival of Perrier in the 1970s. and it's been accelerating recently to the point it's overtaken the consumption of carbonated soft drinks.
I don't know. I don't know whether this is the biggest scam the world has ever seen. I mean, bottle.
Why?
What will you think of next? Bottle oxygen?
Already done. They're selling
the
in China.
The world is too polluted.
They're selling bottled air in China. So take a breath.
Even that's
of
more
air.
Realistic. And now we have this, Trump aficionado or supporter being the head of the EPA. This environmental problem is going to get worse because we're going to be using more and more plastic to just bottle water that we can get from the tap.
Are you saying to me that you've never bought bottled water?
Oh, obviously I have.
Okay.
But
under what circumstances?
When I'm traveling, when I don't have access to clean water. You see, but that's the point, you see. We have been sold this idea that our water is not safe. And most of the time when I buy or take bottled water is out of convenience, right?
Right.
I need to have a drink immediately and I don't have time to boil the water or to go to my tap for water. But the point is, we have been sold this idea that we should be scared about our water. And
right.
Therefore, buy this bottled water, which seems more, safer to drink. I don't know. I think it's a terrible idea.
Well, I just see it as a replacement issue, right? So as societies get more health conscious, they go, okay, I normally buy a soda, or I have a soda with lunch, or even a diet soda with lunch. But now I'm going to switch that to bottled water. So for me, it's more of a shift in the need for, healthy foods, or being more aware about eating right. So health and fitness is a huge trend that I think is the reason why we've seen accelerated gains in bottled water.
Yeah, I don't deny the health part, because these days we don't know what's in our water, and that is as much true. But the point is that in many places you have filtered water. Home, we've resorted to installing our own personal filtered water, and the water at home is already made safe to drink. You know, there are worries on the sideline, but this massive advancement to buy plastic water in a bottle in plastic is just crazy.
Okay,
I think.
So my sister and her husband are water engineers, and they, because as part of their job, they look at so much of the worst case scenarios of when it comes to water, tap water or river water or reservoir water, that they've become paranoid. And I wonder whether that spill, I mean, I can't relate to that, because I'm just like, drink water from the tap, man, whatever. But because I think they know of what goes in the water, even mineral water, you know, like the idea of why have all these added minerals in water? What exactly does mineral water entail? So for me, I don't think about the water, but I'm sure people within the industry who know what goes into it and what remains
in it.
So they boil water.
Okay.
Boiling is often the best way, and purifying. So purifying water to remove minerals is something that they have.
They don't like
they
the
practice,
minerals.
They don't like minerals. So they practice boiling and purified water.
Okay,
yeah.
I want the minerals. I want my
so do I.
Think, trace,
I
calcium,
think minerals
and
are good for me, but clearly they don't agree. And I wonder whether, for me personally, I'm just either ignorant, or ignorance is bliss in this point. I have to say, though, that I probably am contributing to the bottled water revolution because I'm trying to cut back on the soda consumption. I love my diet soda, but
well, you see, that's the problem with that's the other problem with the headline as well, which is the very big headline that water has overtaken soda. So it suggests that soda was right up there in the first place. And that's wrong too, you know, because you shouldn't be consuming so much soda in the first place. And now you're telling me that you're switching back to water, but bottled water at that. It's just, I don't know, Melissa, it feels wrong.
It does feel wrong. And, you know, that you brought out a good point with the plastic. So much plastic that that we're using at the moment for just bottled water, right?
Yeah.
But speaking about beverages, now it's been released, there's been new research that showed that no two drugs have arguably defined human civilization the way alcohol and caffeine have. Because according to some research, alcohol may have helped created civilization itself. In fact, nature created both alcohol and caffeine to kill creatures much smaller than us. Plants evolved caffeine to poison insect predators, and yeast produce ethanol to destroy competing microbes. So there you go. Alcohol and caffeine, the cause, the foundations of civilization.
Yeah, so we're not trying to promote alcoholism here or consuming alcohol, but
or caffeine.
caffeine definitely. I support that
as an addict yourself of
yes,
caffeine.
Yes, I love coffee. But this also stems out of suspicion towards water from our forefathers, because at that time the water was also unclean. So they sought out water that has a degree of alcohol in it to kill off the whatever germs and bacteria might be in there. So the cave people also were suspicious of their water. So are we. We've come round a full circle. We are modern and olden people are suspicious of our water. But of course, it was more fun at the time. They had alcohol too.
Well, that was because, you know, they had issues with purifying the water, as you said, Julian. But
if you've read some of these Charles Dickens books, right? Mm-hmm. They give ale, what they call ale, to the children. And the child would down the ale. I understand it now because the water was very unclean, and therefore you need some fermentation process to purify or to kill off the bacteria in the water. And why not if it makes somebody happy?
Actually, you know, that's really fascinating because almost every culture, every civilization has had some form of their own alcohol. So you've got palm wine from parts of Africa and Asia. You've got rice wine from China. You've got Chilean wild potato alcohol. So really, I mean, it's been a part of civilization across the globe. But what about caffeine? Because that's a more recent
yes.
addition to civilization.
Yeah, that changed the world. Until today, I think people are beginning to have this caffeine fervor, as we've seen in the coffee culture here, to really refine the taste
and
of coffee.
It was really quite interesting because before the Enlightenment, Europeans drank alcohol throughout the day because they didn't have purified water. But because of trade with the Arab world, they had access to caffeine. And coffee is considered a stimulant, right? Caffeine picks you up as opposed to alcohol, which is a depressant. So the world then, again, the mood of the world changed thanks to caffeine.
They were happy before they're just so highly strung now.
After a cup of joe.
But Melissa, you know, it's not just humans that seek out alcohol. The animals do. I mean, you have monkeys, birds, elephants that try to seek out fermented fruit. So this is part of nature, the fermentation of fruits through the natural process makes animals happy as well.
There you go. So as you're enjoying your first cup of coffee this morning, know that civilization was built on the foundations of caffeine. 6:50 right now. We've got the news bulletin coming up in 10 minutes. But first, to take you there, Suede with Obsessions, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.